Bon, donc bienvenue à tous et à toutes. Nous sommes extrêmement heureux d'accueillir André-Marie au Collège de France pour une période d'un mois. Il est arrivé juste il y a quelques jours, il restera jusqu'à la fin mars. Et André-Marie va nous présenter une série de conférences qui seront centrées sur les cuprates supraconducteurs et les avancées de ces dernières années sur des méthodes numériques et des méthodes théoriques qui permettent d'avancer dans la compréhension de ces matériaux en essayant de faire un peu un point sur l'état de l'art du sujet. Je précise que l'ensemble de ces conférences, à part une brève introduction, sera donnée en anglais, mais que je ferai mon introduction, ce que je suis en train de faire en ce moment, en français. André-Marie est un collègue et ami de longue date, et je suis très heureux qu'il ait pu répondre à cette invitation. Vous le connaissez tous, je ne vais pas faire une très longue introduction, mais je voudrais quand même dire qu'il a commencé sa carrière dans le domaine de la physique statistique. Et pour ceux qui ne le savent pas, il est l'un des inventeurs en particulier du concept de multifractal, qui a eu beaucoup d'influence dans toutes sortes de domaines, des systèmes désordonnés, de la matière molle. Et depuis maintenant de nombreuses années, il est devenu un théoricien du problème à n corps quantique, et en particulier de tout ce qui concerne les matériaux à forte corrélation électronique et les méthodes théoriques et numériques permettant de traiter ces matériaux. Il a été à l'origine de nombreuses méthodes pour traiter ces problèmes, par exemple la méthode dite de deux particules autocohérentes à deux particules, two particle self-consistent method, des méthodes d'amas quantiques sous diverses formes qui ont donc permis beaucoup de progrès dans ce domaine. Il est le lauréat d'un assez grand nombre de distinctions que je ne vais pas toutes vous énumérer. Je citerai juste deux ou trois. Depuis 2001, je crois, tu es titulaire d'une chaire de recherche du Canada, qui est une des plus prestigieuses chaires qu'on puisse avoir au niveau canadien. Tu as également reçu la médaille CAP. Et je crois que tu as été récemment nommé APS Fellow. Et donc, après cette énumération des honneurs reçus par André-Marie, c'est un honneur pour nous de le recevoir ici. Et je vais lui laisser la parole.
OK, ben merci beaucoup. Donc, c'est vraiment c'est plutôt à moi que revient l'honneur de m'adresser à vous dans cette enceinte prestigieuse. Et puis, je vous suis très reconnaissant d'être venu en grand nombre. Mais le nombre est suffisamment petit que vous pouvez demander des questions. Ça me fera toujours plaisir de répondre. So I will continue in English. If you have any questions, you can go. I thank you for showing up for this. So before I I skipped. Okay. Well, we'll start with a mistake here. But I know by heart. So there are sort of two pillars of condensed matter physics. One is band theory, and with Fermi liquid theory, which allows us to explain simple metals and semiconductors, and in the end led to the electronic revolution with the transistor. And the other pillar, I would say, is superconductivity, because even though we knew about broken symmetry before superconductivity, it's really superconductivity that helped understand more deeply this concept, and it was at the basis of developments in particle physics, in astrophysics, and so on. And in addition, as you know, it's the in the case of ordinary superconductors, it's the area where we can do the most accurate calculations is superconductivity. I see what happened. Okay, I wanted to skip this. So I will skip it. Okay. It's even worse, I'm started at the wrong No, I started at the wrong course. This is course number two.
So maybe when you are looking for the right slide, I would like to say that it would be great to have these lectures to have a bit of an informal character. So don't hesitate to interrupt with questions and make it a lively event where we can discuss the ongoing status of the team.
Right. So that's it. Now it's the right one. as you know, band theory breaks down. I think here is one of the places in the world where this is one of the most important problems that is studied. But it has been known for a while. And the first example, perhaps, was nickel oxide in the 1930s, where a material with an odd number of electrons per unit cell, or if you want, one electron, one valence electron, was not a metal. And it was understood by Perls and Mott that this is probably due to interactions. a simple way to understand mathematically is through this Hubbard model. You see, he died, he was not even 50 years old, so unfortunately died very young. I never met him. He has a cigarette here. I don't know if there's any relation, but that's what happened. if you take a square lattice with one electron per unit cell, and you allow electrons to hop from one side to the other, and when they are on the same site, you have an interaction U, you find that the Hamiltonian can be written this way. Now, if you don't have this U here, and you have only hopping, we know the ground state is just plain waves. So this is sort of the wave nature of the electron. Now, if you have only a U, the ground state, if you're half-filled, is to put one electron per site, no two electrons on top of each other. Now, in this situation, the ground state, as soon as you put T in, will be antiferromagnetic. And the reason is that it will lower the energy if you add this component to the wave function. And this component you can add only if the spins are anti-parallel, because otherwise the Pauli principle does not allow you to do this. So in second order perturbation theory, you lower the energy and do it like this, so you get an effective model with a positive J, an Heisenberg model with 4T square over U. So the subject of these four lectures will be high-temperature superconductors and layered organic superconductors, both of which illustrate the failure of BCS theory and of band structure and even of many more theories. So since there are a few young people here, I thought I would go back in the old days. This has been repeated thousands of times, but if you're young enough, perhaps you have never seen this. But one of the reasons people got so excited is that if you look at the highest known transition temperature for superconductivity at any given year, you see that in 1987, something spectacular occurred. And all of these compounds have copper-oxygen plane. And I was at this meeting, at the APS meeting, where this occurred. And the New York Times headlines was the Woodstock of physics. So they said they began lining up at 5:30 for an evening session that would last until 3 a.m. I have no idea why they called it the Woodstock of physics. This is what Woodstock looked like. So this was mostly about rock music and drugs. This is the real Woodstock of physics. So about from the only thing eccentric is perhaps a couple of people standing on chair, but other than that, it was pretty quiet. This is quite. I like to show this. This video here, where you have just a pellet of yttrium barium copper oxide, and this is a magnet that's on top of it, and if you just put the liquid nitrogen, what's happening? Where's the magnet? Okay, if you put the liquid nitrogen on it, what will happen, according to you? Last time I asked this question, somebody said it would get cold, which is a correct answer. Any other guess? It will stop boiling when it equilibrates. and you see it lifts. So it's not as if we usually explain this limitation by Lenz's law, but here it's clearly not Lenz's law. I mean, it really shows that superconductivity is is a state of matter that doesn't like to have magnetic fields. So you lower the free energy by pushing the magnet away. It's sort of a heat engine. Okay, now I'm supposed to move to the next slide. So the atomic structure of this compound, they are all like this. They have copper, these are the black dots here, and oxygen in between the every copper, between any two coppers, there's an oxygen. And what's in between these layers is different. And the electricity, the conduction is good in these planes and bad perpendicular to these planes. So they are layered materials, quasi-two-dimensional material. And the role of the rest of the matter here is to just basically put or remove electrons in the plane. If you look at the band structure for this compound, it's one band that crosses the Fermi level. So it should be a metal. But if you look at the phase diagram, you see that at half filling here, so zero doping here means one electron per unit cell. If you go above the Néel temperature, it's a 2 electron volt insulator. So it's definitely not a metal. And if you, I told you that antiferromagnetism is a signature of strong repulsive forces, and you see superconductivity nearby. And in BCS theory, pairing is due to attractive forces. And here we have repulsive forces. So it seems that both BCS and the ordinary theory of and the theory of metals are wrong for these materials. Another example, which is very famous here, I see Denis Jérôme sitting in the audience. These are these layered organic material. So you have to think of this as a side view. So if I look sideways, there are two-dimensional planes of organic molecules. And if you look on top, they form a triangular lattice, an anisotropic triangular lattice that is well described by a one-band Hubbard model. And even though the TC is like 10 Kelvin or 40 Kelvin, it's still a high-temperature superconductor in the sense that all energy scales are sort of down by a factor of 5 or 10 compared with the ITC, but the ratio of potential and kinetic energy are comparable. So we still have a Hubbard model on a different lattice, and these compounds are usually half-filled, n equals 1, and what you can do is change the ratio between T and T prime here simply by changing the anion layer. So I like to see these two classes of materials as a single one, as I explained. The phase diagram, temperature as a function of pressure, that was done here in a Sherbrooke RC collaboration between Bourbonnais and Denis Jérôme, is the phase diagram is like this. It was also studied by Antoine's group. And it has a first order transition that ends at a critical point. And you can go from a metal to an insulator. And there's, if you do Raman scattering, for example, you don't see any structural change on the, going from here to there. So it's really like a Mott transition. And again, you see an antiferromagnetic phase, signature of strong electron repulsion in contact with some unusual superconductivity with a coexistence region. So to see these materials as a single class of materials, you do this. So if we look at the organics first, I just squished the lattice to make it look square here. But it's an isotropic triangular lattice. If you apply pressure, you change the hopping here, and you can apply, you can change properties a lot. It's an organic material. So if you look at yourself and you apply pressure on skin, you see that it has a big effect. And you can, as I said, you can change T prime by changing the anion layer. Now, the high temperature superconductor live here. In other words, they are ceramics. So if you apply pressure, you can change things, and we will see some change later. But you cannot change as much with pressure. And you cannot change T prime over T very much, but you can dope them. So and again, this phase diagram here is interaction, T prime over T, and doping. Now, for the BEDT compound, there are also something that occurs when you change your T prime. So if when the frustration is not too large, in other words, the T prime here is not too large, you get the phase diagram I showed earlier. But when T prime is of order T, so when it looks more like a triangular lattice, you see that you lose the antiferromagnetic phase, and you have some sort of, they call it a spin liquid, so it's a phase that has spin correlations but no long range order that goes to a superconductor. And one, yes?
I have a question on the previous slide.
Yes. Okay, well, it probably changes T prime over T also, and it changes T. It's a little bit in this thing that I showed here, you sort of move diagonally with pressure, but we are not yet at this level of detail to compare with experiment. But because to know T, yeah, you need to do the band structure calculation to find the T prime. But the effect is not very big on T prime, if I remember correctly. Now, there is one other material, which is the equivalent of this spin liquid one, but doped. And I will talk about this a lot also. So you see, it's as if in this plane where you have interaction and doping, the high-temperature superconductors move that way. And this compound, these two compounds, they move that way. So we sort of have access to the same physics, but moving along different axes.
All those are 2D?
Yes. So if I go back to the... Oops, I'm going forward. If I go back to this figure, it's very important, yes, that these material are layered material. And 2D is part of is actually part of the difficulty. So in this material, you see that there's superconductivity. If I go down like this by applying pressure, you see a superconducting dome. And you also see when you are in this strongly correlated state here, I'll show this in more detail here, you see that if you cross the point where the maximum TC is located. So if I just go in the pressure like at 10 Kelvin here, the Hall coefficient given by the red points at 10 Kelvin, you see goes from something that is not very much temperature dependent to when you have half a gigapascal or so here, you go to a large value, which means a small number of carriers. So the effective number of carriers is small, as if you were in a Mott insulator or close to a Mott insulator. So again, the model is the Hubbard model, and it was proposed by P.W. Anderson to apply to the high temperature superconductors. Yeah. We consider only one band for now. I will comment on three bands in a minute. So if in the one band case, as I said, you have plane waves, and the ground state is just found by filling the Fermi C, so when there's no interaction. On the contrary, if there's no hopping, then the ground state is just massively degenerate, and it is just the particle aspect. I mean, you localize the electron on individual sites. And we are interested in the general case where these two terms are comparable. And in some sense, the interesting physics occurs when you have sort of maximum entanglement. None of the two bases is a good one. So the outline of the lectures that I will do over these 4 weeks is as follows. So today I will talk about, it will be mostly an overview, And I will talk about the various approaches, and I will give some answers, I think, for the organics today. I hope to have time. Then in lecture two will be mostly on the whole dope case. So I will talk about the high-temperature superconductors here, but focus will be more in the second lecture. In the third lecture, I will talk about electron dope cuprates, where the pairing mechanism is more weakly coupled. I'll talk about the two-particle self-consistent approach, the role of anti-ferromagnetic quantum critical point. And the last lecture will be more on a little bit more technical on details of these cluster generalizations of dynamical mean field theory. So the outline for today is this. So, okay, I start with a warning. So there will be references, but I don't have time to go through all of them. So sometimes I will flash references, but you can find many references in this review. Well, not a complete review again, but many of the references will be here. So usually when I go to talks and people don't quote my work, I just feel sad and frustrated. And today I still feel sad and frustrated because I know you will be sad and frustrated that I'm not citing all your work. But since I'm giving four courses, you can still come to me afterwards and I can sort of make up at the next class. The other thing that makes me, now I'm more relaxed than I should be, because I noticed that now you have to go through metal detectors to come here, so I feel safer than I would have ordinarily. So, so the outline is this. So now I will talk about the normal state of the high-temperature superconductor, the old dope, then the electron dope. Then I will move to the anti-ferromagnetic phase here. And this will be more or less an excuse to talk about methods, theoretical methods that are appropriate for strong correlations and weaker correlations. So I will be able to do a dichotomy here. And in fact, there will be a break, a sort of a 5-minute break after I do this. I should take 45 minutes altogether. And then after the break, I'll talk about the charge density waves here, and there are experts in the room on this, and the relation with T star. And I will mention some results that just appeared on the archive today, actually, by Louis Taillefer group. And so we'll talk also briefly about this T star, and superconductivity will be mostly in the next lecture. And as I say, I will finish with the organics. So do we have a normal state? So I'm talking about the physics in this region. So I will talk about evidence from the normal state that they are strongly correlated. So without any details of why, you will see that phenomenologically there are strong correlations. So we start with the Matteo-Fieri-Riegel limit. So what is that? If you just write a simple Drude formula for the conductivity, and then you say, okay, the mean free path L here cannot be smaller than the Fermi wavelength, then that gives you the minimum metallic resistivity. And it is given in terms of the conductance quantum and the separation between the layers. And the missing algebra, these will be on the net, so you can look for the missing algebra. It's very simple. So if we look at the resistivity as a function of temperature for the cuprates, you see a YBCO. So the temperature is pretty high here, or lanthanum strontium copper oxide. We always have these copper oxide plane. But you see that you go way above the Matteo-Fieri-Riegel limit. If you look at copper here, it's multiplied by 175, so you never cross this limit. And this is a calculation with Green's function, not assuming Boltzmann transport or anything. And indeed, if you look at the blue line here, when interactions are strong enough, you saturate to the Matteo-Fieri-Riegel limit, as long as you're not in the very strongly correlated limit where you need the Mott physics to come in. Now, another sign of strong correlations and, is this X-ray, very old experiment on X-ray absorption spectroscopy. So let's start with a semiconductor. So a semiconductor, I have a valence band, a conduction band, and these are states where I can remove electrons, states where I can add electron, and if I dope the system, so you remove one electron from the valence band, you just move the chemical potential. Mott Hubbard insulator is very different. You assume that U is large, and you are half-filled. So there are N sites where I can remove electrons. And if I add electrons, now I can add one electron per site, satisfying the Pauli principle. You see that it will cost an energy U now every time I add an electron wherever I add it. So now what happens if I dope? So if you dope, let's remove one site here. Well, now I have N minus one site where I can remove electron, N minus one sites where the energy cost will be U, and I have two sites where the energy cost will be essentially zero, where I put up or down electron. So you see the spectral weight has completely rearranged and I move the chemical potential. Now, this is you can see this here in this figure. So the peak to the right, this sort of magenta peak, corresponds to, you see the photon energy is huge. So it corresponds to taking a core electron and taking it here in the upper Hubbard band. So this is zero doping. This is this magenta curve. Now, if you dope a little bit, for example, the green curve, now you can take the core electron here or in these states. So now you have two peaks, you see? You have two green peaks. And it's clear from the figure that this is going down slower than this is going up. You see the distance between the various colors. So, you know, one of the peaks corresponds to these levels and the other one to this level. So this is a signature of the fact that you are in a dope Mott insulator, not in a semiconductor. Now, this is not completely obvious, and that's why I mentioned the three-band model, because the real compound have oxygen in between the copper. So suppose this is a copper site, then the oxygen is slightly higher in energy, but it is less correlated, so that it will be filled more than the copper here. So the structure of the density of states will be like this. You have the 2N oxygen sites, and this is a copper site where it's separated by U. So this so-called charge transfer energy here plays the role of U. And you see that if you dope with holes, you think, okay, it will look like doping a semiconductor, but if I dope with electrons, it will look like doping a Mott Hubbard insulator. So these, it's not a priori obvious that the one-band Hubbard model will be good for this. But if you take these experimental results and many more, and you plot the relative intensity of the two peaks as a function of hole doping, the experimental points are the dots here, and the solid line is calculation with the one-band Hubbard model using cluster dynamical mean field methods. And you see that, well, at least it's not inconsistent with the data. Another signature of strong correlations is that the Hall coefficient, here is the Hall resistance, multiplied by doping, so multiplied by X, and you see that for small doping, then the curves all go roughly to 1, which means that the Hall resistance, the number of carriers that you extract is really like 1 over the number, the number of carriers is the number of holes. If you look at the density of states, so that's measured by scanning tunneling microscopy, you see it's extremely anisotropic. It's much easier to remove electron than it is to add electrons. So that's another signature that it is a Mott Hubbard insulator. Now, if you look at the magnetic uniform susceptibility or the night shift, and I guess Henri here was first to make notice this point is that in an ordinary metal, the magnetic susceptibility would be temperature independent. That's the Pauli susceptibility. Here instead, you see that there's sort of a pseudo gap that opens up at this temperature. In angle-resolved photoemission spectroscopy, so this is a plot of the probability that an electron, this is the upper quadrant of the Brillouin zone, so it's sort of just one quarter of the whole zone. And the Fermi surface of non-interacting electrons, or the band structure Fermi surface, is these dots here. And the results from angle-resolved photoemission spectroscopy tell you that it's much more probable, this is the red region, to have electron at the Fermi level that sit at this point, and the probability goes essentially to zero if you go far away. So it's as if you had gotten rid of part of the Fermi surface. That's again a signature of strong correlations. Electron dope cuprates are less correlated. This will be the subject of the third lecture, so I won't spend much time, but I will just tell you that if you look at this same curve, resistivity as a function of temperature, you see that there's a tendency here to saturate at high temperature, and you're not very far from the Mott-Yoffe-Rigel limit. Okay, now let me speak about the anti-ferromagnetic phase. Are there any questions?
Mm-hmm.
In the two particles that consistent, it saturates. But if you do the dynamical mean field theory, then it can go through without any problem.
But so how do you reconcile these two?
All that I would say is that this is less strongly coupled, when you're at a U that is below the critical U for the Mott transition at half filling, this Mott-Yoffe-Rigel criterion works perfectly well.
So, in the absence, in the strong coupling regime, there is no reason.
No. No. It's a very important remark. Yes, Catherine?
Could you give a bit more details on why the electron dope is less strongly correlated than the whole dope in a few sentences? You said that it's more difficult to add the electrons on.
Well, one reason, they don't have the same structure, so screening can be better, and I will show you that even within cluster, you see that the screening is probably better in electron dough. And if you do more sophisticated dynamical mean field calculations of the band structure, you also find that the effective U is smaller. And this is just an empirical fact, I would say. And if U had been large, it would have been a better model of the one-band Hubbard model for the reason I just showed. It just happens that it's less strongly correlated. If you can see already from the optical gap, the optical gap here is 1.3 eV instead of 2 in the whole dope, and the pressure dependence of TC also suggests that it's like that. So I will go in more detail, but let's take it just as an empirical fact now.
Yes, could you talk back it was a little bit faster, on the core levels. So you were saying that from core level spectroscopy you get
directly. Yes, I was saying that if I go...
You do a core level and then you can also excite probably frequency.
You can excite what?
Yes.
Okay. It's just that there is some very deep level.
There is a core.
Yeah. There's a core. There's an electron there, and it's not overlapping with its neighbors. So it has a very well defined energy. Then you come with this huge energy here, 530 eV. And you this is basically where the electron is in this core, and then the transition. The X-ray will be absorbed if there are some large density of final states. So here it will be absorbed at this point.
It's
X-ray absorption. This is X-ray absorption, yes.
Sorry.
Yeah. And then if you, the other peak corresponds to exciting here. Okay? So we're talking about this anti-ferromagnetic phase now. So what is a phase? And very often we're just happy to find the symmetry of the phase, and it's because if there's a phase, there are some emergent properties that won't depend on the details of the phase. So for example, in the anti-ferromagnetic phase, you have broken symmetries, namely time reversal and translation by one lattice spacing, but the two together are now a symmetry. And because of these broken symmetry, here it's SU2 symmetry, you have Goldstone modes that correspond to spin waves, you have a single particle gap. But if you look at, as soon as you move away from zero frequency, there are differences depending on whether you come from a weakly or a strongly correlated limit. So weakly is that U is small compared to the bandwidth, and strongly is U is large compared with the bandwidth. So, for example, the ordered moment will be smaller in the in the weakly correlated limit, and you will have Landau damping, so you won't get spin waves all the way to J. And the normal state will be even more different. If in the weakly correlated case, the normal state will be metallic in three dimensions, and insulating if it's strongly correlated, and the pressure dependence of teeny L will be different. So, one way to summarize this is to look at the phase diagram sketch. If you're atta-filling in the unfrustrated three-dimensional cubic lattice, so if I plot temperature and interaction strength, this is the phase diagram. You have some anti-ferromagnet here. And the nail temperature goes down here because you see as U increases, this Heisenberg exchange goes down. And here it goes up because the interaction U favors the anti-ferromagnetism. Here the physics is that of Slater. So it's just nesting, a sort of weak coupling perturbation theory. Here the physics is Heisenberg. So you start from localized moments and the order. And where is Mott? It's right there. You have to go from something that has a Fermi surface to something that has no Fermi surface. So this complicated crossover here is really what's left of the Mott transition in this context. And suppose you are in a very frustrated lattice, or you are in two dimensions, so that long-range order is only at zero temperature. Then what you will see is that there is a crossover line continues all the way to zero temperature, where there's a first-order transition between a metal and an insulator. And this is the first-order line that we saw in the organics. The BDT organics. And these are results of dynamical mean field theory. Now, as a theorist, you want to make difference between strong versus weak correlations. It turns out that there are very few methods that apply in both limits. So let me make contrast with the method. So in the ordered state, one thing you could do, I mean, was done a long time ago by Schrieffer and Zhang, is to start from mean field, add the fluctuations, and get some ordered moment that is not very far from what's observed experimentally. if you're strongly interacting, then you can start from spins, so you just have spins, and you can do stochastic series expansion, high temperature series expansion, quantum Monte Carlo, word line, there's all sorts of methods that allow you to treat this problem. And the result was the ground state of the spin a half two-dimensional model is an anti-ferromagnet. At the beginning, there was a discussion of whether it was something that it does not order or not, but now I think we agree that it orders. Suppose you're in the paramagnetic state now. What sort of methods are you going to use? One of them would be random phase approximation. So random phase approximation is nice because you satisfy conservation laws and you satisfy the Merman-Wagner theorem. No, you don't, actually. That's the problem. Yeah, and you violate the Pauli principle also. So I will show you in the third lecture why that is. There's another approach that's due to Moria, where you take Hubbard-Stratonovich decomposition and you the 5-4 term, you decompose in a mean field way. But then you have adjustable parameters, like the quartic coupling, you have an effective interaction, and you don't know the link to the original model, and you also use the Pauli principle. There's another method that's called fluctuation exchange approximation, which is basically like Eliasberg theory. So you take a Green's function, you exchange a spin wave here, and what you find is that you violate the Pauli principle, and in cases where you should have a pseudo gap, you don't have it, and the reason is because you need some vertex, it's right technical, I'm sorry here, but it's not so important. The vertex needs to be at the same level of approximation as the propagators here. Yeah. Well, the Pauli principle in its simplest manifestation, in other words, if I compute the expectation value of n up square, right? In a one-band model, on one side, n up is either 1 or 0. It happens that the square of 1 or 0 is 1 and 0. So it means that this should be equal to n up. Now this you can compute by taking the difference between the spin and the charge fluctuation. So you can compute this in RPA. And what you find is that this will not be true. So that's what I mean. So the Pauli principle has many more consequences, full anti-symmetry of four-point functions and so on. So that's more difficult. But this one is very simple and it should be satisfied. So something that works is the renormalization group, but you have to go to two loops to get some non-trivial results, so it's quite complicated. So what I'll describe in the third lecture is a two-particle self-consistent approach, or the general philosophy is to drop diagrams and instead impose constraints and some rules, conservation laws, Pauli principle in the form I just wrote, local moment and local density, some rules, and you get for free the Mehren-Wagner theorem. I will explain what this is. This came from nuclear physics, this concept, and consistency between one and two particle quantities. Okay, so that's for weak coupling-like methods or weak correlation-like methods. Now, if we are in strong correlations, so strong correlations, in the normal state, what could you do? In one approach, it's a Gutzwiller approach. It's sort of a mean field approach that gives the Mott transition. There are various variational approaches. There are slave particle approaches where there are many experts here in the room, Catherine, Antoine, and so on. And I like the slave particles because it makes the physics come out clearly. On the other end, what I like less is that very often there are many ways to do the slave particles and they give different results. But I would say that once we agree on what should be the qualitative features of the solutions, then you can look for the slave particle theory that gives the right answer and some physics will come out more clearly. Yes, Catherine?
Just a question of semantics. Mm.
You can go perhaps all the way to intermediate coupling, but it's justified really when the coupling is pretty strong. And I say two loops because otherwise you don't get quasi-particle renormalization. You don't get the Z if you stay at one loop. But still, you can do many things at one loop, like finding the phase diagram. There's another approach that's called extremely correlated Fermi liquid. Sriram Shastri was here a few years ago, and he explained this in detail. As far as I understood, I don't think this applies in the pseudo-gap regime. You have to be, am I correct? I think you have to be sort of away from affilling. Then there are phenomenological approaches, right? Like this Wang, Yang, Rice, and Zhang approach. They have a phenomenological wave function, Green's function, I'm sorry. And there are numerous papers written by Carbot and Nicole who looked at this, start from this and that, and find many results that sort of agree qualitatively with many of the of the results. So that's another possible approach if you want to know just the physics. Yes, Catherine. No. They're extracted exactly from this. So they have, they take the T prime and T double prime and T from experiment, then they, not from, well, from band structure, if you want, and this delta zero is can be obtained from renormalized mean field theory. Yeah. This comes out.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there are ways you could argue that this Greek function makes sense.
Very nice. And what you in the ladders, what is nice, I guess, in Karin and Maurice Rice is that you can do things much more rigorously than just a simple mean field theory.
So this one is taken from mean field
theory. Yes. Yes. Just mean renormalized mean field theory. So you have Godswiller projectors, and but in the end, it's you have to take it just as a phenomenological form. So the method I will be discussing here is a cluster generalizations of dynamical mean field theory, and I take this quote from Freeman Dyson, who said the effect of a concept-driven revolution is to explain old things in new ways. The effect of a tool-driven revolution is to discover new things that have to be explained. And I would say that in the case of dynamical mean field theory and cluster generalizations, we sort of have the two at the same time. In the sense that the basic idea, the concept, is that you want to take into account both the atomic physics and the wave aspect of the problem. And the tool aspect is that it is you need very often you need numerical solutions to the equations, and in recent years there's many progress in developing the tools, the numerical tools to do this. So I'm sort of don't feel comfortable of explaining dynamical mean field theory in front of this audience, so I won't spend any time, but the point is that in infinite dimension, the exact solution of the Hubbard model looks like this. You take one site, and this is like a quantum impurity in a bat, and you compute of non-interacting electron. You compute the scattering rate, the lifetime, or if you want, the self-energy for this impurity problem, and then you see that this self-energy is good for the lattice. And then you project the lattice, so now that's the wave aspect, if you want. You project the lattice on the single site, and if you don't get the same density, the same single site density of state as before, you need to readjust the bat until this is self-consistent. So there's a review article by Antoine and company. It turns out that in two dimensions, the self-energy is not only frequency-dependent, it's momentum-dependent. I showed you some momentum distribution curves that show this. So the way to go about this in a systematic way is to take larger and larger clusters, again with always a bat and the self-consistency condition. Instead of single site, now we have clusters. And this is cellular dynamical mean field theory or cluster dynamical mean field theory. And there's a version that is a sort of periodic, where you do things in momentum space, that's called dynamical cluster approximation. And there are two different generalizations of this single site that converge to the same result when the cluster is big enough. And there are a few review articles here. Now, the positive, there's plus and minus with this. Long range order is allowed by allowing symmetry breaking in the bat, only in the bat. So then the cluster, you never break any symmetry. There's no artificial mean field that's done on the cluster. You just allow symmetry breaking in the bat. You include short-range dynamical correlations and spatial correlations exactly in short-range, but you neglect the long wavelength particle hole and particle-particle fluctuation. That's the thing that is missing. And so details on the method will be in lecture 4. And there are many active groups. And I will not be able to show all the time the contribution of everyone. But I want to make clear that it's not a one-man show here. It's really a collective effort, as is often the case in science. So in Paris, there's Antoine, Olivier, and Michel. In Rutgers, Christian Aulé, Gabi Cotillard. Mark Jarrell is in Baton Rouge now. Andy Millis at Columbia, at Gould at Michigan. Thomas Meyer and Okamoto at Oak Ridge. And then you have a group in Tokyo. Sakai is not here anymore, right? But he was a postdoc here. At Jülich, Liebsch. And then you have in Graz, Hamburg. And Marcello is here in the room and at the LPS. Luca in Grenoble, Massimo Caponi in Trieste, held in Vienna. Giovanni Sordi, my collaborator in the Royal Holloway, and our group in Sherbrooke. So now is the time for the break. And what I will do after the break, okay, that's all my lectures will be like this. So if you don't like the show, you can leave, nobody will see. So that's a good advantage. And also in the second part, not today, but in the second part, like in lecture 3 and 4 in particular, it will be more technical in the second part. So now what I will do in the second part here is to talk about charge density waves and the relation to the pseudo gap. And I will draw the phase diagram of the organics found from these cluster methods. So I propose 5 minutes.